It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. Every so often, a new literary movement coalesces. A new generation of writers finds a voice. Well, it's happening again, and this time, they're young, gifted, and native.
Noelani Konsna ischan nuksaak kashohai ai ish tastalo. My name is Noelani. I'm nuksaak and shohai ai of the Stalo Nation. I write for our stories that have been historically silenced.
My name is Lisa Luella Tiger.
My name is Douglas Boots.
My name is Chi Brassi, and I am Dene Torkeglininishle. I'm of the Water Flows Together clan.
I'm enrolled with the Muscogee Creek Nation.
Of the Siboney tribe.
And I write because I love to read.
I couldn't find anybody else to tell my story.
A story that has not been told.
There are stories I want to read that haven't been written yet.
Uanga Kuganinupiatun, and my name is Chandra in English.
My name is Zoe Johnson. I'm from the Sault Ste. Marie Chippewa tribe.
Inupiagarunga, Singasak Mulurunga, and I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska.
I write because I'm tired of feeling like the only one to exist in the world the way that I do, and I don't want other people to feel that way.
I write because hope. The verb.
Remember their names. A new wave of Native writers is coming of age. They're fierce, fresh, original. Today they're MFA students, but in a few years you may see them on the bestseller lists. Already people are talking about a new Native Renaissance. And at the center of it is a one-of-a-kind MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. Director Jennifer Forster told Charles Monroe Kane that the goal is to rewrite the literary landscape.
We're the only MFA program that focuses on Indigenous voices. It's run primarily, and the vision of the school comes from a multi-tribal Indigenous perspective, a Native perspective. It was founded by Native artists because so much of like American literary landscape has had the dominance of a certain kind of voice and author for the last 200 years. And it's about time that we start to hear all the other voices that have always been here.
Speaking of authors, you have two authors that graduated from MFA program recently.
Mm-hmm.
Therese Myatt and Tommy Orange, who both had bestsellers in 2018. What does it mean for your students, for your program, to have these really now famous people who like just were famous, like within months ago? What is that like for your program?
You know, what's beautiful about the program in my experience of it, it's a community. Everyone's so proud of each other. And it's inspiring to all the students. They're definitely role models. It encourages all the other students to say, you too.
Right.
You too can.
Right. It must do that, right? If you're 19, Native woman, and you read Therese Myatt's book, and then she's a bestseller, that would make me take my writing more seriously.
Well, I'll say that the writer that inspired me to want to write is Joy Harjo. I'm Muscogee Creek, and Joy Harjo is Muscogee Creek, and my mother gave me one of her books of poems when I was 13 or 14, and that's how I felt.
Yeah.
I was so inspired by it, you know.
Yeah.
You can see yourself in the story, and most of the time the stories are trying to tell you who you are, rather than you saying, I could tell myself, I could tell my story.
I was searching on the internet, looking around for New Native Renaissance. I couldn't believe how many times it's been used and who's talking about it, like within months.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it premature? I mean, what do you think of that phrase people are throwing around?
Well, I think that we've had literary revolutions for a long time. You know, it's not the first revolution. It's an amazing revolution, and it's something to celebrate. And we are at a different place right now than we were 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And there is a movement. There definitely is a movement. Yeah, we're writing our own stories, which are multiplicitous. It's not just one Native story. That's the point.
Earlier today, I'm sure you saw part of it. We asked all your MFA students three questions.
Mm-hmm.
What is your name? What is your tribal affiliation? And why do you write? I'm going to turn those questions to you.
Oh, no.
You must have guessed I was going to ask that.
No, I didn't. My name is Jennifer Forster. My tribal affiliation is Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. I'm a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. I write poetry because it's the only language that can point to the thing that you can't point to, the thing that has no words. Words are not bones. We are what comes before words, what comes between them. When the light changes in the forest.
Jennifer Forster directs the MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. Her latest book of poetry is called Bright Raft in the Afterweather. And she was talking with Charles Monroe Kane.
Getting us to cities was supposed to be the final necessary step in our assimilation, absorption, erasure, the completion of a 500-year-old genocidal campaign. But the city made us new, and we made it ours.
That's how Tommy Orange opens his debut novel, There, There, which is one of the big breakout books of 2018, a best-selling, multiple award-winning, genre-busting epic that is not set on a reservation. It's set in Oakland, where Tommy grew up.
Plenty of us are urban now, if not because we live in cities, then because we live on the internet, inside the high rise of multiple browser windows. They used to call us sidewalk Indians, called us citified, superficial, inauthentic, culturalist refugees, apples. An apple is red on the outside and white on the inside. But what we are is what our ancestors did, how they survived. We are the memories we don't remember, which live in us, which we feel, which make us sing and dance and pray the way we do. Feelings from memories that flare and bloom unexpectedly in our lives like blood through a blanket from a wound made by a bullet fired by a man shooting us in the back for our hair, for our heads, for a bounty, or just to get rid of us.
Tommy Orange is an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes in Oklahoma. He sat down with Steve Paulson recently to talk about urban versus reservation blues.
So, Tommy, this is a passage from your prologue, which is kind of this 10-page tour de force of sort of the sweep of history from the old genocidal stories of absolute brutal massacres right up to the urban Indians of contemporary America. And I have to say, this is, it's a pretty unusual thing to write at the beginning of a novel. Why did you want to include this prologue?
You know, I wrote it for, I thought my audience was just Native people or Native people from the city. And even though a lot of people think that just because you're Native, you're sort of born with knowledge, and it's not true. And I found out about a lot about history researching for the book.
So you did a lot of research going into this book. Yeah.
So to understand what an urban Indian is, you kind of have to go back to relocation and genocidal policy. And if you're going to go back there, there's other stuff that you have to go back to, and what's the beginning of the way this country has thought about Native people. And that goes all the way back to the beginning. Also, knew I wanted to include the Sand Creek Massacre because my dad grew up telling us that story, probably the story we heard repeated the most.
What is the story of the Sand Creek Massacre?
In Colorado, we had a deal with the U.S. government. We had an American flag flying above where we were camped at Sand Creek. And the idea was that we're protected and we're not going to be attacked because we have that flag. And we had a white one up too. The men went away to hunt, is how my dad told it. There was a group of militia, about 600 men. They drank all night nearby and early in the morning came with howitzers, you know, basically machine guns. It was women, children, and elders, and they just slaughtered them. Probably over 200 people, also mutilated them. Just really horrific stuff. There was this idea that we need to be terminated.
What was it like for you to grow up hearing that story a lot?
I knew from a very early age that I was made up of two things that seemed to be in conflict. Didn't help that my parents fought a lot and had religious differences. And so for me, I knew there was a really dark and intense history of Native and white people. And I was somehow supposed to make sense of being both.
Because your father is native,
yeah.
Your mother is white.
That's right. So it's a confusing thing.
Now, in that prologue, you talk about the rise of the urban Indian, and that's sort of the story of this book. Usually, the stories that we tend to read about from Native writers, most are, to my knowledge, are set on reservations. Are these two totally different worlds?
The reservation writing has its place, and it's part of the canon, and everyone knows it. But I think the number for at least 10 years has been 70% of Native people in the whole country are living in cities. And to not have had any representation of what that story is was pretty mind-blowing to me. A little bit scary to not have anybody to, you know, how did they do it sort of thing. But also, I think it left me open to do what I wanted with it because I didn't see it out there anywhere.
Hmm.
So I'm not necessarily writing against reservation experience, just there was just a big void of story. And we're already an invisible population in this country. And the urban Indian, doubly so. There's no representation in movies or literature or TV.
Hmm. You tell this story of your novel through a lot of different characters. So each chapter is sort of told from the perspective of one character. Why did you want to structure it that way?
It was at first something that I loved in reading books that have a bunch of voices and figuring out how they all are connected. So it was a craft thing that I loved and I knew I wanted to do. It just so happens that also coming from a voiceless people, to have a whole bunch of voices in one setting and having them all connect works really well against voicelessness. Also, there's a monolithic version of Native people that is still pretty prominent. This is what it means to be or look like an Indian. And it's deeply damaging because people who struggle with identity, varying degrees of connection and blood, the stick they have to measure themselves by is a historical Indian in a headdress or, you know, no other people are asked to look one single way. I think it's a systematic tool for erasure.
Can you tell us about a few of your characters? I mean, just to give us a sense of the range of the different kinds of experiences you wanted to write about.
Yeah, it ranges from young people to old people and in between. The book opens up with a character who has fetal alcohol syndrome. And when his grandma tells him, one of many characters being raised by a grandparent, she says fetal alcohol syndrome, and all he hears is drome. And he's seen differently by society, and he knows he's supposed to be stupid, and he's sort of smart about that. We have a filmmaker in the next chapter, and then we have a little girl in Alcatraz who we get a later chapter when she's older, and she ends up being the grandmother of these three boys who ride their bikes all over Oakland, and one of the boys learns how to dance watching powwow videos on YouTube. A couple of guys in their 20s from kind of a tougher part of Oakland, and there's a woman fleeing an abusive boyfriend in Oklahoma and trying to make her way back to Oakland. You know, that's kind of the range.
And they all come together in this climactic scene of a powwow in Oakland.
At the end of 2010, the idea just popped in my head. That was the basic premise. It wasn't, none of the characters were there. It was have all these characters converge, or their lives converge at a powwow in Oakland at the Oakland Coliseum. And then I spent the next 6 years writing into that.
Hmm. Did you go to a lot of powwows when you were growing up?
I didn't. I remember one when I was 5, but I don't remember hardly anything but a lot of dirt and an orchard to get away from the dirt. And then when I was like 18 or 19, years after my parents had divorced, my dad came back into town and randomly took us to a powwow at a Berkeley gymnasium. An old friend was dancing. It was the first time I saw a dancer, and it was a powerful moment.
So one of the questions that keeps coming up in your novel from the perspective of a lot of different characters is, who is a, quote, real Indian? And it has to do with what people look like, who their parents were, especially if there was a white parent, how they were raised. Was that a question that you had to deal with when you were growing up?
You know, to some extent, I struggled because people just got what I was wrong. I was often assumed Mexican or Asian in high school, even to the point of getting in fights because people would call me racial slurs. Maybe there's some kind of identity crisis around the way I think the world sees me, and maybe other natives see me. But I always felt pretty solid in knowing who I was. It's part of the native experience in contemporary times. It's almost, to be an authentic native, you have to have questioned your authenticity. It's almost like a part of the experience.
It's sort of this self-consciousness is built into the process.
Yeah.
So you said that your father grew up speaking Cheyenne. I mean, that was his first language. Did he pass any of that on to you?
I wish. The time period was much more assimilation. You know, he worked full time and my mom doesn't speak the language. So there's only so much time to do it. And if the parents aren't talking, he would have had to have really gone out of his way to make sure that we were speaking it from an early age.
Have you ever wanted to learn the language?
Yeah, my sister actually just got fluent.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I'm working on an autobiographical family novel that is going to infuse Cheyenne in ways that have made me very interested in understanding it more. I don't know that I have the time or discipline to become fluent. It would be a dream come true, though. It would be amazing to talk to my dad in Cheyenne. So I don't know. I'm open to it, and we'll see.
I'm curious about how you became a writer. I've talked with writers who have said that they knew from an early age, like 10 years old or teenager, that they were going to be writers, that was their destiny. Was that true for you?
Not at all. I wasn't a writer or a reader. Did not do particularly well in school. I knew that I was good at sports. Nobody encouraged me particularly to do anything in school. No conversations about college. I got really into roller hockey, started playing on the streets in Oakland, and then eventually indoor roller hockey and tournament level. And then I became a musician when I was 18 and went to school for sound engineering. It wasn't until after I realized there were not very many good job prospects after graduating that I got a job at a used bookstore. I was interested in philosophy books, and Borges and Kafka really caught my attention early on because they're sort of the bridge between philosophy and fiction.
So this is like you're in your 20s by this point. I mean, this is a pretty unusual story, I think, for a writer. I mean, because you're still young.
Yeah.
And I mean, to really discover the world of books, not until your 20s. I mean, even as a reader.
Yeah. And so because of it, because of how behind I knew I was and sort of convinced myself immediately that it's what I wanted to do, I knew how much work I had to do. And so I read as much as I could and I wrote as much as I could.
Did you just do this on your own or did you join like writing workshops?
No, I just did it on my own. You know, I moved to New Mexico one time for a year and just waited tables and went really hard at reading and writing at that point.
I have to say, this is just an amazing success story to hear you describe this. I mean, without that kind of background as a reader, as a kid, and then basically teaching yourself how to write, and then given all the acclaim that you've gotten for this book, I mean, it's kind of stunning.
Yeah, I became pretty obsessed. Then I found the Institute of American Indian Arts. And so about halfway into writing the novel, maybe like 9 years after I made the decision, like I want to write. And 3 years into writing this novel, I got into the MFA program. So everything that's happened is very much exceeds what I had envisioned.
Right. Yeah, now you're up for prizes and all of that. No, there is a lot of talk right now about a new generation of Native writers that's been called a Native Renaissance, and you are put into that group of younger writers. Do you see this happening? I mean, is there something new going on right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is another one of the Renaissances that people have talked about. There's this one after the Civil Rights or during that time period, and there's one in the 90s. I think there was like 19 Native writers being published at major...
Well, there was this whole period of sort of N. Scott Mamaday, Louise Erdrich, Leslie Marmon Silko. I mean, sort of this incredibly vibrant period. And then later, Sherman Alexie, who seemed to dominate Native writing for at least a couple of decades. And now it seems like there's a new generation. And I mean, do you see what you and some of your fellow writers doing? Is it very different than those earlier writers?
I think it's different in that we're all wanting to write in a modern, contemporary way. We are all aware of not wanting to be that Indian.
That Indian being what?
The one that we're resisting, the one that is out of date and...
The reservation Indian?
Just the stereotype, or I think everyone's trying to do something that's not been done before. I think we're all products of our time, and we're writing very much with the times in mind. I think that automatically makes us different.
Look at all around, look around at the whole thing. If your skin is brown, then you're down for the old pain. Look at all around, look around at the whole thing. If your skin is brown, then you're down for the old pain.
Tommy Orange. His debut novel is called There, There. And that was Steve Paulson talking with him. So Tommy has a best-selling former classmate, Therese Myatt. They got their MFAs together, sold their first books within 2 weeks of each other, and now they're both adjusting to literary stardom. Therese is from the Seabird Island Band in British Columbia, and she wrote a slim, devastating memoir about a childhood filled with abuse. It's called Heartberries, and it reads like poetry. Here's what it sounds like.
Do you know the reservation received your body like Christ or the Holy Ghost or the Father? Sel si tome te al se il sometel. Are you Perpetua in the den? Was I the infant you tore from your chest before you walked toward the lion? Mother, can I know my inheritance now? Is the fall of man your story, Wazinik? Not that you were born to a green world and trespass, but were born into the blood. Were you the corporeal manifestation of a spirit world, your leather jacket and brown body and fist holy? God foreordained Eve's transgression. He didn't see you, though. You were stealthier than Eve. So stealthy, there is no text of you until now. You are folklore and rumor, and there is a myth a man took like the apple, but of your person. If the fall of man was purposeful, then so are your transgressions. If there were no fall, there wouldn't have been an incarnation. To ascend, there must be a dark, a descent. Is that why, Wazinik, our fathers were prisoners? My brother doesn't talk about it, but I do. Zel, zitome ta'al, itzomel, zel.
That's Therese Myatt, reading from Heartberries. She was on the show recently in an hour on writing truth. If you missed it, you can find it on her website at ttbook.org. And hey, while you're there, you can also check out our video playlist of new releases from American Indian musicians, including all the songs in this hour, from hip-hop to pop to indie and more. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
Yad e, tash teri nishe. Horich inin chlon bilgana bashishchin, chicheitcha chininle. I write to heal.
My name is Nita Spotted Wolf.
My name is Gordon Lee Johnson.
My name is Jennifer Brady.
I'm Hadatsa and Chippewa.
I live on the Paula Indian Reservation.
I'm of Paiute, Chicana, and European ancestry.
And I write because the stories never seem to leave me.
I write for my children and to know my grandmothers.
I'm Kuya Capeno, and I write because I can't dance.
Bekat Bansa Ujra Bentiko Dana Eslan. I write because the only thing I want to leave in this world is my stories.
Yad e she e shena April nez yin chie tachini nishlin ashini bushes chin katnizani desha che kinsachini desha nele look at you guy de nasha. Hi, my name is Shana Nez. I'm from Lukachigai, Arizona, and I write to set the creative souls free.
Meet the next generation of Native writers. MFA students at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. So here's a question that might seem kind of obvious, but bear with me. How do you know when a book is Native American? I mean, seriously, is it because the author is Native American? Or the characters? Because it's set on a reservation or uses Native language? This is the kind of puzzle David Troyer likes to set for his students. Troyer is Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. He's a literature professor at USC, a writer and a novelist, and he has issues with the very phrase Native American literature, at least the way it's traditionally used.
Native American literature is literature written by Native people, about Native people, that has coded in it Native worldview or sensibilities. And it becomes largely an exercise in identity politics. This gets us in hot water because if you remember, Forrest Carter's memoir, The Education of Little Tree, was taken as Native literature. People talked about how much of Cherokee culture was represented in it and how poignant it was until people realized that Forrest Carter didn't exist. Little Tree wasn't a memoir, that it was fiction written by Asia Carter, who was a white supremacist and a speechwriter for George Wallace.
I mean, that still stuns me. I remember when that news came out, and I remember people who loved that book so much,
right,
they would not believe at first that it was fiction and written by a KKK person.
And then all of a sudden, it doesn't have a Native sensibility. It doesn't have Cherokee culture, because now we know something about the author that's unsavory. 2 months ago, you said that this thing was a Native thing, and now it's not a Native thing. This proves that identity is at the heart of, at least it was, still is in some ways, at the heart of how we understand our literature. And if we persist in that attitude, then the literature will, and this is my end game and this is my concern, the literature won't grow and won't remain vibrant and interesting.
So when you sit down to read a new novel, say somebody puts a novel in your hand and you know it's by a Native American author, what do you hope to find? And maybe more importantly, what do you hope not to find?
Whenever I read a new Native American novel or book of essays or whatever, I say a little silent prayer to myself before I crack the spine. I'm like, please don't do that same old thing. Please don't do that same old thing.
What's the same old thing?
The same old thing is a book full of Indian people wondering what it means to be Indian. Because N. Scott Momaday's House Made of Dawn, published in 1968, I could be off by a year. Abel, the protagonist, is kind of wondering how he fits in. He comes back from the war and he doesn't quite fit into his native community. He goes to Los Angeles and he gets beat up in the city and he comes back and he finally reconnects with his tribe. In Leslie Silko's Ceremony, we have Teo also coming back from a war, also trying to figure out, does he belong? He's been scarred and traumatized both by the war and also by being an orphan. He leaves the reservation. He has awful experiences off the reservation. It comes back and after a moment of crisis is reintegrated with his tribe. You know, that kind of story I've seen before. The problem that Native American literature continues to experience is the same problem that, say, Asian American literature and film continues to experience. And my colleague at USC, Viet Nguyen, who won the Pulitzer Prize mm-hmm. for his book, The Sympathizer, has a wonderful way of conceptualizing the problem. he was writing a review of the movie Crazy Rich Asians, and he mentioned in his review there are many hundreds of movies made by Asian people about Asian people. We don't suffer from underrepresentation, but what we do suffer from is what he calls narrative scarcity.
Hmm.
That there are still only a few kinds of stories told about or by Asian and Asian American people. And I think that we are in a similar situation. Collectively, we still suffer from narrative scarcity. There are only a few kinds of stories that are being told, and I want different kinds of stories.
It's not just that these are the stories writers are telling. It seems like these are the stories we want to read.
It's hard to get people to tune into a story about a Native accountant who has a midlife crisis and sleeps with his or her secretary. You know, we don't have a Native Updike. I would love to see sort of Native writers taking on something like that. When people think about Natives, they think about suffering. We are trained to think about suffering in relation to Native people and not to think about much else, except for maybe the palliative of glorious and beautiful oneness with the earth and animals and crap like that. I'm sorry, but it's true. We have all been trained to understand Native stories as necessarily involving crisis, suffering, 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 reconnection with the kind of tribal past, end of suffering, roll credits.
You mentioned the love affair with Native spirituality. So remember in the 1990s and the early 2000s, this was around the time of the New Age, and so many white people were falling in love with Native culture. They were going on vision quests and taking part in medicine ceremonies and playing Native flute music and wearing Coco Pelly t-shirts, and maybe that's still going on. Why so many wannabe Indians? And what's your reaction?
I mean, starting in the late 60s and 1970s with the hippies and the Back to Earth movement, think of where American culture was at that time. The promise of the city on the hill had been destroyed. Both Kennedys had been assassinated, so had Martin Luther King, so had Malcolm X. We had suddenly realized that our government didn't always have our best interests in mind and was more than willing to lie to us, enter the Pentagon Papers and so on.
No, a lot of us were coming of age at that time feeling that to be an American was to be ugly.
Exactly. And at that time, in part because, you know, the rise of the American Indian movement and the ways in which it forced Native people into the consciousness of the country as a whole, Native peoples were all seen as antidotes to the ravages of Western Judeo-Christian capitalism. And so we were not implicated, in the imagination at least. Native people aren't responsible for Dow Pharmaceuticals and Dow Chemicals making napalm. Native people aren't responsible for the war in Vietnam. Native people aren't responsible for slavery and Jim Crow and structural inequality in America. So we were so perceived as being so far outside of all these things that people glommed onto us as a kind of answer.
Well, they were looking for a kind of purity, which is exactly what you were saying has stifled Native American literature.
Right. And so on one hand, we offered purity. On the other hand, we offered catharsis, because never has a more pure and more guiltless people, again, in the imagination, because in the historical record, we're guilty of many ravages and extinctions and wars and bloodshed and abuse, right? Tribes perpetrated all sorts of atrocities on one another. We trapped all sorts of animals to extinction and near extinction. Why is there no megaflora or fauna left in North America? Because we killed all of the mastodons, right? We killed all of the camels. We killed all of them. We also kept slaves, by the way. And the Cherokees had African slaves.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. They had plantations. Cherokee and Creek and, to a lesser degree, Chickasaw, they kept slaves. They were Southerners as well as Natives. They were both simultaneously.
So how come these stories don't show up in Native American fiction?
Because it doesn't sound good. Because our role in the literature is to be both pure and pure sufferers. That's our cognitive function in American consciousness.
I mean, David, what I hear is I hear you issuing a challenge to other Native writers. But I want to know what challenge you would issue to readers. because we're part of this relationship that you're describing. We are consuming Native culture in the form of novels, and partly, as you're describing, to assuage some complicated feelings that we have ourselves. So what's your challenge to us as readers?
Okay, here is the challenge to readers, both Native and non-Native, just readers generally. The challenge is in three parts. One, do not read Native American literature as though it's some sort of liberal act of social good. Reading a novel does not take the place of activism. It is not activism, okay? It's consumerism. That's one. Two, when you read Native American literature, hold the writers to a high standard. Don't evaluate that literature in terms of to what degree does it grant you access or seem to provide access to Native thinking. Three, ask for more. Ask for more. And ask for more sort of in what gets written next, but ask for more from the book that's in front of you. And remember that that book is related to other books. Try not to sort of read Native American fiction as only an extension of Native life, but as an extension of American literature. And if you can read it that way, you'll start to see connections. I tell my students this all the time. I tell them, a book's nearest relatives are other books, not real people and lived communities. Louise Erdrich is fascinating because she takes tricks and moves and sensibilities derived from Faulkner and from Flaubert and reimagines them in a Native context. That's why she's brilliant. That's why she's interesting. Not because love medicine resembles Winnebujou stories.
So don't ghettoize fiction.
Exactly. We have so many really, really talented writers. Tommy and Therese and all the other writers I mentioned. And if I could get all of them in a room, I would say the same things to all of them. Like, let's go for more. Let's try more. Let's try to write different books. And like, let's do this. Because there's so much talent in the field right now and so much of an opportunity to make tracks. I'm really excited.
Writer and novelist David Troyer. He's Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. He teaches at USC, and his latest book is called The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. That's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX.
Bujou, Ozawaki Jagokwe Indishnakas, Bekajanong Dunjaba, Mijikan Dodem.
From another world.
My name is Amy White, and I write to say the hard things that need to be said and heard for all of us to heal. I do this for my Anishinaabeg community, but also for the larger Indigenous community across Turtle Island, Miigwech.
I'm Vivian Carroll, Cherokee Nation poet. I write to breathe life to the images uncorked in my psyche.
My name is Victoria Gonzalez. I'm from Santa Fe, Nuevo Mexico. I'm Zacateco, and I write fiction to entertain.
My name is Blue Tarpalichi. I'm Muscogee Creek from Okmulgee, Oklahoma, and I write to continue the 400-year tradition of Creeks writing.
Mi nombre es Sharon Ann Henderson, Dene At'ane Nishle. My name is Sharon Henderson. I'm from the Dene Nation. I write to heal, to carry messages of hope and love for self and others, to be an example for my daughter to never be afraid of her own voice.
More voices from tomorrow's writers, creative writing MFA students at the Institute of American Indian Arts. So these voices represent different Native nations and tribes from all across North America. But do you have to be Native American to write Native American fiction? Kevin Gooden grew up among the Salish people on the Flathead Indian Reservation. His brothers and his stepfather are tribal members, but Kevin is white. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him about his new book of poems called Anaphora. And I should warn you, they're about suicide. Here's one.
When Jimmy told people he could fly, nobody came. So when he let loose his rope, he was alone. But all night long over the roofs of the trailer court, people could hear him calling, "Get out of bed, you motherfuckers. I'm Harry fucking Houdini, and I can fly."
Wow, that's an amazing poem.
Thank you.
Tell me about Jimmy. Who is Jimmy?
Well, Jimmy's a cousin of mine who grew up on the reservation. He has or had a sister and a brother, and his mother would drop them off at our trailer house when she was working at the gas station, so we would all hang out at the house when we were little kids. He was a very sensitive, kind of mischievous person. He was the life of the party. He'd be really, really quiet and shy, and then he would say something that just busted everybody's gut. And you could tell there was something that he was dealing with as he got into his teen years. And when he turned 21, he was living back at home. He had left his girlfriend, said he had to figure some things out, moved back to his mother's house, and she was working the night shift at the gas station. And when she came home, the house was cold. The fire in the wood stove had gone out, so she went out to get firewood, and he was hanging there.
Oh, that's terrible. I just want to say I'm sorry to hear what happened to your friend and your cousin, but that was 25 years ago. Why write about him now?
Well, it was November, the month that he ended his life, and suddenly it was like I was just sort of transcribing what was being given to me. It was as if Jimmy was giving these poems to me to write. I didn't sit down and say, now I'm going to write about Jimmy. It just happened.
You know, one thing I read about it, which I found very surprising, if you could explain it, I guess, is that on the reservation after Jimmy committed suicide, they didn't speak of him, right? They wouldn't speak of him at all.
No, nobody has said anything. I did bring him up to my mother and a brother of mine. I said, what may have happened there? And this was long after I had written the work that I have written. And my brother, who he had had a few cans of his favorite Montana microbrew by this time, and he said, "Nah, Jimmy looked into the abyss and saw that life was meaningless." So that was all that was ever spoken of him after the funeral.
It's like they tried to obliterate his memory. I mean, doesn't that seem strange to you or upsetting to you?
Yeah, well, I've carried that wondering and I suppose a kind of anger about that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's a situation of shame. There's some sort of stigma of shame about somebody committing suicide.
I want to stop here just for a moment because I think it's very important that we talk about something here just to clear up. You are not Native American. So how did you end up having a cousin and brothers who are Native?
Interesting question. So my mother and stepfather got married when I was 4. And shortly thereafter, we moved up from Missoula, Montana, up to Pablo, Montana, which is on the reservation. So I'm like the whitest person you could ever imagine. I have blondish, now reddish hair, but when I was a kid, it was like neon white.
So what was it like growing up an Irish-Swedish kid on a Native American reservation? What was that like?
Well, it was one of those sort of surreal situations when I started going to school. Kids traditionally played cowboys and Indians and so on, I suppose. We played Indians and Custer, and I was Custer.
You were Custer, man.
So I learned how to run very fast. Growing up on the reservation was a gift. My stepfather taught me a lot about the environment. He worked for the tribe in their reforestation program. So he would tell me a lot about various trees. We'd talked about animals. There was a time on the reservation where if a tribal member was married to a non-tribal member, the non-tribal member and guardians could go hunting. The caveat was that the non-tribal members could not shoot an animal, of course. So we would go with him out in the woods, and he would teach me about tracking animals and survival skills and all of these wonderful things. And so that aspect of it was a gift that a lot of kids don't get. He took me to some places that now non-natives can't go. So I got to witness parts of the landscape that are kept away from non-natives.
You lived on the reservation basically your whole life, right?
Yeah. Yes, I did.
So I got to ask you a question. It's a loaded question, but I think it's one we have to ask you. If culturally and so much of your life, even spiritually, is Native American on this reservation and you were raised there, do you consider yourself an American Indian?
No, I can't do that. When I'm on the reservation, when I'm back visiting family and stuff, it's great to be back there. It feels like home. And we always make jokes about my awkward whiteness. My parents will introduce us to friends of theirs, and my brothers will say, this is our oldest brother. He's the albino in the family. Or, you know, when I was a kid and my stepfather would take me down to Kmart down in Missoula, you know, I'd run around looking at all these toys and basketball hoops and so on. And then I would be trying to con him into getting something. And I'd say, well, we really need this and we really need that. And he would stop and look at me and he'd say, what's this we, white man? You know, so we tend to make jokes about the fact that I'm much more pale than everybody else.
In your heart, and I don't want to overpress this, but like,
yeah.
But in your heart at 3 a.m, and you know what I mean, or you're going for a walk in the woods alone, like, who are you? Are you in limbo? Are you white? Are you Native? I mean, what are you?
Well, it's hard for me to say that I am this or I am that. I kind of live in that space in between that's undecided.
What about this book? Is this book Native American poetry?
Boy, I don't know if I would classify that as Native American poetry. I mean, that's part of the subject matter, of course, but I think I would wince a little bit if somebody called it a book of Native American poetry.
What do you call it?
This is going to sound obvious. I call it a book. I don't put it into any categories. Maybe it's just a book about trying to deal with the loss of somebody who was close. An elegy, let's call it that.
An elegy, that's fair. It seems like Jimmy is lost. Because no one remembered him, he is lost. And I know you're trying to bring him back through the book and through the words. But I also read your poem, and there's another guy that's lost in the poems, and that's you. Are you in purgatory with Jimmy?
I hadn't thought of it until you mentioned it, but
oh,
let's go with that.
Sure, yeah. Sure. So you are in purgatory with Jimmy?
Yeah.
So what brings you guys back?
Well, there's the hope, I guess, huh?
Yeah. What are you hoping for?
For myself, not much, but I'm hoping that Jimmy, because he's in print, he gets to last longer than he would have if he weren't in print.
Wow.
That some aspect of him remains in the world. You know, when I go away, something of him will remain. Because right now it seems that I'm pretty much the only one that considers him.
Can you read another poem for us?
Yeah.
It's the last poem, page 69.
Sure. Falling snow begins to shine. November, Jimmy tucked into the ground, Joe Grady flame. I take a selfie at the water tower, the warning light strobing, and I think about God, how untranslatable his actions are to the yearnings of our little moments, when we sway grateful to feel it all, tomorrow, and when we return to the beginning of our calling and remember the flourishings and write them in a book. We say home is what is granted, and yet I am here in the methed out ghost town to which our childhoods will always belong.
Gavin Gooden, reading from his new book of poetry called Anaphora. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him and also produced this hour. So normally at this point, I say goodbye, read the show credits, mention our distributor. But today, Ojibwe hip-hop artist Tall Paul is going to close the hour with a rap to the Great Spirit. It's an Anishinaabewan, and the words ask for strength, love, and help in keeping the old ways, in living a good life.
Get ye money do, we do kawashin, jamushka wizzy yan, me dush ba me it is a yan, me jishanam zagye e way when gnu jishanam bizendal with shanam, me wane janugga mo yan, ni mashomis we do kawashanam, j I budget too young and nishanabe is your twawin, me jibbe get came to mind, kay ya nishanabe be my dizzy win.